Anyone and everyone is welcome. For more information, please visit aus.arts.ubc.ca or check us out on Facebook.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake. There's nothing more for any.
Welcome back. Today is Friday, January the 8th. I'm Megan Devlin.
And I'm Leonardo Coelho. You're listening to the first 2016 episode of News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:08 and time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news.
Up first, we have News 101 financial reporter Alex Norman interview with Natalie Deckers.
We also have News 101 correspondent Lauren Calgers interview with Hugo Lapointe of Mining Watch.
Finally, we have a special treat for the new year, our discussion panel of the top news stories of 2015.
But first, some headlines for today. In campus news, UBC faculty pen open letter about sexual assault response. A group of UBC professors have released an open letter apologizing for UBC's policies and slow response to reports of sexual assault. In November, the Fifth Estate documentary, School of Secrets, revealed that UBC took more than a year and a half to act on multiple allegations of sexual assault and harassment by a graduate student. At the time, UBC's interim president, Martha Piper, issued an apology letter promising to review and improve the university's policies. Released this Wednesday, the faculty's open letter states that, quote, "The current problems do not seem limited to the efficiency or timeliness, and we need more than a discussion." 43 professors initially signed the pledge to action towards, quote, "improving UBC's policies and procedures regarding sexual assault and related matters of safety and equity." Since then, over 30 more names have been added. The letter calls for active consultations with students, faculty, staff, and experts within and beyond the university to produce new policies and procedures to be released before September 2016.
In local news, ex-KGB agent gets second chance to return to his home in Burnaby. A former KGB translator in Burnaby resident may have another shot at coming back to Canada after a recent federal court ruling. 55-year-old Mikhail Lenikov is a Russian citizen who lived in the basement of Vancouver's First Lutheran Church for 6 years to avoid deportation. Lenikov voluntarily left sanctuary this past August, several months before the federal appeal court would overturn a ruling that rejected his application to stay in Canada on humanitarian and compassionate grounds. The new decision, which was unsealed last month, now clears the path for Lenikov to reunite with his family, who currently live in Burnaby. Lenikov came to Canada in 1997 but was ordered for deportation in 2009 due to his past involvement with the KGB. Hadate Nazami, Lenikov's immigration lawyer, said of the decision, quote, "Basically all the doors were shut, completely shut. And now you can see a door opening slightly, and that's significant." Nazami also added that the previous decision to remove Lenikov was based on, quote, systemic biases of the Harper government which influenced the decision. Judge Elizabeth Hennigan raised concerns with the previous immigration officer who previously handled Lenikov's application. Nazami said Lenikov was happy with the recent court decision, stating, quote, obviously it was an important decision. He's happy about that, but certainly he's still away, and something needs to happen for him to come back to Canada.
In national news, transgender student says Canadian census needs to include a third gender option. Quinn Nelson, a student at the University of Calgary, has written a letter to Minister Navdeep Bains asking that Statistics Canada change the census to reflect the realities of 2016. Nelson, a non-binary person who identifies as neither male nor female, wrote in the letter that, quote, as a non-binary transgender individual, I would be wholly unable to fill out a census, long or short, accurately and completely. In an interview on the CBC, Nelson said that the census is used by policymakers and government to make decisions and that acknowledging Canada's transgender population could mean the allocation of healthcare resources. Statistics Canada responded to Nelson's letter advising Nelson to leave the question blank by selecting neither male or female and to indicate in the comment section why the question was inadequate. Nelson is satisfied with the response, but says the next census should include three options, male, female, and other. The 2016 census has already been printed, but Statistics Canada has said that it will hold consultations about the addition of a third option for the 2021 census.
In international news, our militia seizes Oregon wildlife refuge. On January 2nd, the militia seized the headquarters of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in Burns, Oregon, in response to the, quote, tyranny of the United States government. The refuge was closed and empty for the holidays at the time. The militia took up the cause of imprisoned Oregon ranchers Dwight and Stephen Hammond, who were convicted of arson in 2012 after setting fire to federal lands. They are also protesting government ownership of Western lands. In a video released by the Oregonian militia member Ammon Bundy stated, quote, while we're here, what we're going to be doing is freeing these lands up, getting the ranchers back to ranching, getting the miners back to mining, getting the loggers back to logging. Though the armed occupation has not caused any violence, the threat of violence remains. And his brother, another militia leader, told the Oregonian that they were willing to, quote, kill and be killed if necessary. In response to the occupation, many have mocked the militia on social media and the way they have been treated by the law enforcement and the media, using hashtags like Yali Al-Qaeda and Vanilla ISIS. The militia plans to stay on the reserve until the government turns federal land in Hammond and Harmon County, where the refuge is located, over the residents of the area. Bundy said, quote, that could be a week, that could be a year.
Escaped Mexican drug lord El Chapo has been recaptured. Joaquin Guzman, a.k.a. El Chapo, the drug kingpin of the Sinaloa cartel, has been arrested by Mexican authorities. Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto announced the arrest via Twitter, writing in Spanish, quote, mission accomplished, we have him. I want to inform the Mexicans that Joaquin Guzman Liora has been detained. The arrest happened after a raid by the Mexican Marines this morning in Los Mochis. Five people connected to Guzman were killed in the ensuing gun battle, while six others were arrested. One Marine was also injured, and at least one member of the cartel managed to escape. 6 months ago, Guzman escaped from a maximum security prison in Mexico through a hole in his shower floor leading to a mile-long tunnel. Guzman previously escaped from prison in 2001 and was captured in 2014.
Those are your campus, local, national, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments.
The UBC English Students Association is hosting the Colloquium, their second annual conference, on Saturday, January 30th, from noon to 6 in the Dodson Room in the Irving K. Barber Learning Center. The colloquium will feature presentations from English students as well as future faculty presenters, including Dr. Robert Rouse, Dr. Tiffany Potter, and Dr. Adam Frank. Attendance to the colloquium is free and refreshments will be provided, so please visit the UBC English Students Association on Facebook in order to reserve your free ticket.
This week on the Arts Report, film, theater, dance, books, visual art, and more. Every Wednesday at 5 p.m., the Arts Reporters explore what's fun, fascinating, campy, or critical in the Vancouver art scene. You can find bonus content on our Mixcloud, Facebook, and Twitter. Got an idea for a review, interview, or original production? Email arts@citr.ca. Listen Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or anytime on citr.ca.
Do you like Friends? Well, we like you. So become a member and get a Friends of CITR card. Not only does it make you special, but it gets you all kinds of deals with our friends on Commercial Drive, like 10% off at Stormcrow Tavern, High Life Records, Audio Pile, Mintage Clothing, and more. Visit CITR.ca for more, or come check us out in the Nest.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. Broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Up next, we have a special weekly financial report with UBC senior financial correspondent Alex Norman and Natalie Dakers, president of and CEO of AxelRx. Natalie is the 2015 winner of both the British Columbian and National Entrepreneur of the Year Award, presented by Scotiabank and Startup Canada.
This is a special weekly financial update report with Alex Norman. This week we have a special guest, Natalie Dakers, President and CEO of AxelRx. Welcome, Natalie, to the show. Who are you?
Well, my name is Natalie Dakers. I live in Vancouver, and I'm the CEO of AxelRx.
And what is AxelRx?
AxelRx is a unique, it's one of a kind in Canada. It is a health sciences accelerator, which is focused on enabling Canadian health sciences to grow, to stay and grow in Canada. And we do that by providing seed capital, along with our partner, BDC, the Business Development Bank, as well as spending time understanding what the company really needs as far as maybe there's some gaps in people or maybe they need some resources around some of their planning that could be regulatory, financial, business. What we try to do is bring some people to the table that can fill in those gaps.
How does it feel to win Startup Canada's National Entrepreneur of the Year Award?
Winning an award is always a very nice feeling. It always comes down to a lot of different people contributing to something like that happening. But I think for me, the awards really become secondary. And the thing that I think is really important is this community that they're putting together is really driven with a common interest to bring greater attention to entrepreneurship, to innovation, to small companies. And these are all things I care about. And so while the award is really nice, what actually has been the main benefit is really becoming part of that community and being able to work with them going forward with our shared interest to see more things happen in Canada, more attention being brought to the importance of innovation and how we believe that this is really going to have a high impact on Canada and being able to contribute to its growth, essentially.
How do you think winning the award will impact AxelRx going into the future?
I think for all the same reasons that what Startup Canada is doing is it's a grassroots organization, which means you've got a lot of passion from a lot of younger people who really believe in the mission. Their interest is to bring greater attention to the importance of innovation, to entrepreneurship, to startup companies, how they're impacting Canada's growth and why they're important. And I think because it's coming out of this grassroots organization, it can really have a fundamental impact. And I guess for Accelerex, because what we're trying to do is support early stage companies in the health sciences. Much of the technology that we're supporting is coming out of universities, coming out of commercialization centers that have been started by the federal government through these centers of excellence. And so we're all aligned in what we're trying to do. And so I think by being a participant in the award, it's brought greater attention to what we're trying to do. And we can certainly leverage all the community that Startup Canada is building.
About yourself, what motivated you to want to get into the health science industry? Where did you get your start?
Well, and this is kind of nice because this interview is coming through the UBC radio station, where in many ways it all really began. I mean, initially I'm a marine biologist, but I got involved in the whole intersection of science with business by joining the technology transfer office at UBC some time ago. And what I mean by that is I worked in that office really through the 90s, which was an incredibly high growth time for our biotechnology sector in Canada. So I feel like I really grew up with the sector, and I was working with some remarkably entrepreneurial people at the time. This was the leadership of the office at the time, but also scientists. So what was seen as a very effective path to deal with, because our job basically was to work with a bunch of different interesting technologies and figure out which one of those might have commercial potential and get them into industry. And the group that I was working with really believed that company creation was a very effective means of doing that. So I learned tons about intellectual property, project management, business practices, many different technologies, shall we say, the good, the bad, and the ugly. So I really got a fantastic fundamental training through the tech transfer office. I was there probably almost 9 years. Ultimately spun out my own company with one of the scientists I had been working with. So decided that it would be good to try it myself, which was pretty exciting.
Your journey to get to where you are today, have you experienced any challenges as an entrepreneur?
Of course. I don't know any entrepreneur that hasn't faced challenges. I mean, just by the nature of being an entrepreneur, the biggest thing everybody talks about is being able to deal with failure. And again, I think in the context of health sciences, we have such a remarkable attrition rate. You know, a lot of the drugs, like essentially 1 in 10,000, really make it through to that final commercial sale. So you're dealing with an enormous amount of failure. But before you even get into that kind of thing, it's, again, understanding, you know, what you can bring to the table and what else you need. Your failure may be the technology. It could be maybe you've made the wrong choice of the person, or you haven't been able to raise the money that you needed at the right time. There's lots of different things that can go wrong. And I think as an entrepreneur, you absolutely have to expect that things are going to go wrong. And so it becomes a question, well, what do you do about that? How do you mitigate your risks? What's your backup plan so that when you face difficulties, it's not like you've seen it only one way and only one way will make it succeed. And therefore, if you can't follow that path, then everything falls apart. That's a sure way to see a shorter path to whatever you're going to do. I think you just have to expect that things are going to go wrong and plan accordingly.
Yes, if everything went perfectly, I guess it would be a pretty boring world.
Well, it would, and wouldn't everybody be doing it, right?
I agree. One of my last questions here, what advice would you recommend for the next generation of entrepreneurs who are looking to aspiring to start their own health science company?
My advice to the entrepreneur who wants to get into this is do your homework. We all fall in love with the ideas that we want to pursue, and that's where the passion comes from. That's the tenacity, absolutely essential. The challenge, though, is you have to be objective and really understanding what the opportunity is. What's the unmet medical need? Do your homework to make sure you understand, where do you fit into the market opportunity? Do you understand the competitive landscape? If you're out there raising money, investors know, they have remarkable networks. They understand, they see so much that they're going to ask all the hard questions. So you got to make sure you've done your homework. so that when you're presenting your idea, you recognize the challenges. Every opportunity is going to have its challenges. Nothing's made in the shade right from the start. But at least if you recognize what those are and you're building a plan to address them, then that's a massive step forward versus somebody who turns a blind eye and just goes forth hoping that everything's going to work out. So I think for entrepreneurs to spend a lot of time up front really investigating the opportunity, speaking with people, and then getting people around them, whether it's through a group of advisors or early board of directors, scientific advisory board, whatever that might be, but just getting that group of people that can bring accountability right from the get-go so you don't have to reinvent the wheel right from the start. There's been so much learning so far. There's very sophisticated people that young entrepreneurs can turn to. And frankly, Startup Canada is a perfect community for these young entrepreneurs to turn to help them to develop that group and really get their, you know, best foot forward right from the start.
Well, that's great advice, Natalie. I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to be able to speak with CITR. This is Natalie Dakers from AccelerX, President and CEO, and the winner of Startup Canada's National Entrepreneur of the Year Award. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate this opportunity tremendously. I feel very connected to UBC. It's a pleasure to be on your show, and I hope that I've shared some interesting thoughts, and we'll look forward to seeing how things grow in the future. And I'd just like to also say thank you to Startup Canada for the remarkable opportunity of taking part in their Startup Awards and being part of it.
Thank you, Alex. Now we have News 101 correspondent Lauren Calger's Mining Watch report.
In a mine, where a million diamonds shine. We dig from early morning light.
This is Lauren Calger reporting from the Climate and Environment Desk here at News 101. I am here today with Hugo Lapointe of Mining Watch Canada, and he is in British Columbia today to tell us all about what we should know about mining here in BC. Hi, Hugo. What are you doing here today?
So it is part of my mandate to tackle mining issues all across Canada. Canada is a powerhouse for mining internationally, but we do also a lot of mining domestically. And the three main mining jurisdictions in Canada right now are Quebec, Ontario, and BC. Mm-hmm. And so I intend to spend quite a bit of time in BC during this mandate that I just started with Mining Watch this year. I'm hoping to come here maybe two or three times a year, spend a few weeks connecting with communities that are affected by mining, First Nations communities, but also non-First Nation communities, connecting with policymakers, lawmakers, and different civil society groups, environmental groups, in the hope to effect positive changes in the way mining is being regulated and mining is being conducted environmentally, socially, and in terms of human rights and First Nation rights perspectives.
Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of us here in the city, we don't necessarily, we're not so much involved with mining. But BC, as you said, is a pretty big player. Can you give us some idea of what kind of mining operations are in BC?
The important thing to keep in mind is that try to have a perspective on the global trends of mining and where do we fit as citizens that consumes metals. What we're seeing over the last 10 to 20 years is that there's more and more mines on the planet digging for metals. The mines are becoming bigger and bigger, but the grades, the quality of the metal in the rock is actually diminishing. There's less and less metals. Often the average is way below 1% of the rock that you extract is actually metals. So 99% is actually waste that you need to store on the land forever. And you need to make sure that that waste doesn't spill anywhere. So we're on a trend where the environmental impacts related to water consumptions, to energy consumption, to footprint of those mines is getting bigger and bigger when there are communities around that are affected more. And you also see increasing human rights issues as well across the planet. So I think we're at a stage that, a bit like the climate justice, like energy issues have done over the last 10, 15 years, we need to start thinking about the mineral mining metals impacts and how we can affect positive change. And one of those areas is probably we need to start thinking of reducing some of those metal consumption in our lives. And, you know, it's going to be different depending on the metal. You talk about, you know, gold is certainly a big industry, probably 30 to 40% of all mines on the planet are gold mines. But gold, what is gold, you know, used for? Well, primarily jewelry. So maybe we need to think about that. Whereas iron is, and copper and nickel is different. That's primarily used for urbanization, city building, industrialization, some electronics, which have a different purpose for societal needs. And so with this in mind, you know, Canada then, and BC in particular, need to think about improving its overall footprint for mining.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be tackled from different angles. And one of the some of the angles that we work on is policy and regulatory reforms for better protections of people that are around mines, better protection of the environment, community support. So those that are affected by mining can get a proper support, technical support, or strategic support when facing choices of mine near their communities. And then the other angle is corporate accountability. So it means like targeting companies, shareholders, companies' boards to try to make them accountable for their choices and the way they operate mines.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we think of mining regulation here in BC, we most people tend to think of the Mount Polley disaster, which happened in 2014, August, right?
Right.
Can you give us a bit of background of that disaster and the ongoing issues around that?
Yeah, I mean, like the Mount Polley disaster was the biggest mining spill in the history of Canadian mining, and probably one of the biggest environmental spill in the whole history of Canada. We're talking about nearly 20, 25 billion liters of liquid and solid waste that was spilled and destroyed the Hazelton Creek over almost 10 kilometers long, and then spilled into Quesnel Lake in the Quesnel watershed downstreams, which eventually reached the Fraser River. The immediate impacts were water bans for a few days or weeks, and then, of course, instant killings of all the animals that were in the way of that massive spill. But the long-term impacts are still unknown. There's a lot of contaminants that went into the watershed that may affect future salmon fishery and so on. There's also impacts that were on the local businesses, whether they be, you know, recreational, touristic, fishing, hunting businesses that were in the area. And, of course, the impacts on the First Nations people that use the land or have a deep spiritual connection with that land were very affected by that spill. Now, a year later, where we're at, well, in terms of the reaction from the government did recognize there was a problem. They did commission a technical report that was published in January, which assessed what happened. And they also suggested, that report also suggested, to change a lot of the regulations and the way mining tailings are being operated. So there's currently an ongoing review of the what we call the mining code to see what we can change in terms of tailings management.
Mm-hmm.
We're still a bit concerned about the direction that it's taking. There's some positive step being done by the BC government, but probably not enough. So that's why a lot of our work in 2016 will try to focus to push the government for greater changes and with these massive wet tailings pond, which we should try to avoid at all cost with, and going with alternatives which are less risky. And just recently, like 2 weeks ago, there was another major spill in Brazil, Samarco, another mine. But again, that reminds us that this issue is not only a BC issue, it's a global mining industry issue. And while BC is reviewing its regulations now, we also need to push internationally and in other countries to do the same, so that overall the global industry, mining industry, is doing a better job at protecting the environment and the communities around.
Because a lot of mines are based in Canada that operate internationally. So,
in fact, 60 to 70% of all mining companies across the planet are registered in Canada in one of the stock exchanges, whether it's in Toronto or Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
It's become a specialty of Canadian business. So that means, in our opinion, that we have then a higher responsibility as a Canadians to make sure that this industry is not destructive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you notice any differences between how BC regulates its mining compared to other Canadian provinces?
Absolutely. And, you know, I wouldn't say that there's one province that is perfect. I think there is positive or more progressive or higher performance criteria in some other provinces. So, for example, Quebec just changed its mining laws over the last 2-3 years. They now require greater financial assurance prior to mining. That means that there is money set aside for in case the mining company goes bankrupt, and then we need to clean up that site because there's always a site to clean up after. You know, BC is not quite that same level of financial assurance. That's a problem because you and I and taxpayers in BC are on the hook. So, you know, if Montpoly Imperial Metals go bankrupt tomorrow, we inherit the bill to clean up everything. There is also improvement that we're done in Quebec regarding community choices. So now municipalities will be able to designate no-go zones for mining in their territory. So zones that are too sensitive ecologically or economically or socially will be out of bound for mining. And that is a major issue in all across Canada. Letting community do proper land use management and designate areas where mining could go and others that it should not go. And BC does not allow that, actually. So most of the BC land, over 80%, is open to mining, and the communities have practically no legal means to say no to mining.
Wow. Okay, well, thank you so much for your insights. Any last thoughts? I know you're trying to, again, there has been trends, as you mentioned, towards this kind of self-regulation. You're trying to rebalance that through the work of Mining Watch.
That's right. The self-regulation is an issue where over the last decade we let the industry control its own operation, control its own pollution monitoring, and so on. And so, and that is out of balance. We need to come back to a more oversight from the government and the ministries. And that was part of the lessons from the Montpoly disaster too. But that's also clashing with the trend that we've seen across governments in Canada, where governments want to cut. In their budget year after year, reduces expenses. But that logic has its limitation when you don't have any more expertise in the ministries to do the job they're supposed to do, that is protect the public interest, protect the environment, and protect the communities.
Thank you, Laurie. We'll take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for our panel on the top stories of 2015.
For over 30 years, there has been one voice in the local Vancouver art scene that has stood above the rest, and that's Discorder, that conspiracy, punk rock, foxcore, sassy, still publishing magazine from CITR. We're one of the established and trusted voices of Vancouver's music and arts culture in the Lower Mainland, with 8,000 copies distributed monthly to over 135 distribution locations, from the Lido to Zulu Records.
Discorder is one of a few magazines published by a community radio station, and we only serve up the freshest local and Canadian goods.
We have interviews with artists, album reviews, live show reviews, and articles about everything important to our crazy, unique, varied, and amazing culture in Vancouver and across the country.
Pick up your free copy of Discorder today, or sign up to have it delivered to your door wherever you are.
Check out our website for distribution locations and all the information about advertising and getting involved.
Join us every Saturday from 8 till noon for Saturday's Edge with your host, Steve Edge, as he guides you on a journey to world and roots music, with African, Latin, and European music in the first half, followed by Celtic, blues, songwriters, and Cajun in the second half.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, daily grassroots, global, unembedded, international, independent news hour. And this is CITR 101.9 FM.
Cue it up Wednesdays 3 to 4.
I mean, I just wanted to do a nice experimental music radio show and maybe throw in some
feel when you're talking that anonymous, like a private sense in your podcast.
I mean, I think I can talk and that's good enough.
Fight or flight music sometimes. For things that are not alright.
I just
radio essays and travesties, radio catechisms, half-baked philosophy and criticism. Experimental beat music, avant-garde, post-punk, industrial, noise, ad nauseum. Cue it up. Wednesdays, 3 to 4 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM.
Now, we have our discussion panel of the top news stories of 2015.
Thank you, Megan. So today we have three of our regular News 101 correspondents, reporters, slash headline writers, and they've gone out, done some research, and have compiled some of their picks for the top news stories of 2015. We're going to start things off with Sam. Sam, why don't you introduce yourself and what you're going to be talking to us about today?
Hey, I'm Sam. I'm a journalism student here at UBC, and I've hosted a few times, written a few headlines in my day.
Yeah.
Going to start off with a pretty obvious one, being as we are in Canada. The election happened.
It did,
like a little bit less than 3 months ago, like 2.5 months ago. And now we've got Justin Trudeau, we've got the Liberals, got a majority. And I really wanted to sort of get a sense from, you know, our illustrious panel. how do you feel it's going? You know, he made a lot of promises on the campaign. Few of them have been sort of broken or maybe weren't realistic to keep in the, in general. A few of them he's sort of, you know, actually fulfilled already, and a lot of them he just hasn't really talked about. You know, like the inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women, mandatory long-form census, tax cut for the middle class, although your definition of the middle class maybe differs from his. Like, that's all stuff that he did. But, you know, the Syrian refugees, he said that they were going to have 25,000 in by the end of the year, and they've got 10. Although they have a plan for getting the other 15 in quickly, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
He said they were going to end ISIS airstrikes, and there wasn't really any timetable given for that, but it was like sort of implicitly said, at least, that it was going to be fast, and there's been no end to that. And then there's electoral reform, which is sort of the one that I want to get people's take on, and that it's one of the more important ones to me personally. The issues that he just sort of hasn't talked too much about since being elected.
Why don't we take electoral reform?
Yeah.
And break that down, because that was one of the biggest, arguably like one of the biggest reasons for a lot of people voting the Liberals in, is that they wanted to see a change in that system. Eva, who is another regular on News 101, you've lived in Montreal, so you've seen like Trudeau mania firsthand. Was there like what's your take on the electoral reform? Like, was that a big thing for you and maybe fellow people in Quebec?
Well, to be honest, the last time I was in Montreal, it was Jackomania over at the NDP and Jack Layton. But
that was back in the 2011
federal
election.
Yeah. So I didn't really witness the Trudeau mania there, and I don't think it would have been quite as manic, I think, as you might think. But in terms of electoral reform, I think that's actually the promise that's going to be the most difficult for Trudeau to keep, because there's not that much he can do about it necessarily. If, you know, now the conservatives are saying that if they want to do electoral reform, there has to be a national referendum on the question, and that if there's not a referendum, the conservatives won't support it, and that their senators in the Senate won't support it. So Trudeau and the Liberals could actually have a hard time getting electoral reform through as an actual bill if they don't hold a referendum.
We also have Alice, who is from the UK. Say hello, Alice.
Hi.
Do you understand the Canadian electoral system as it stands, like currently, you know, like with this past election? You've just been, you've kind of had a crash course on it with the past election. So
yeah.
What's your take on it?
So I arrived in Canada for the first time in September. And so it was a bit of a crash course, like you said, to get my head around it. I mean, in terms of the actual way that the system works, it's it goes by the UK political system. So the voting in terms of that is no different. But what you do have in Canada is the scale, which for me, and from what I've heard from like fellow people on my course and fellow Canadians as well, is just how that kind of impacts the provincial and federal, to how that's related to federal government side of it, is a lot more complex because of the scale of Canada. So from what I've gathered so far, that's a huge challenge for how the system works here compared to the UK. I'm not saying that either.
That's a correct observation.
Yeah, yeah, I'm not saying that either is particularly good. Like, we have challenges with how the system works within the UK, but we don't have the mass, the scale that Canada has that makes it so particularly difficult to get your head around and so difficult to get a clear judgment of what everybody in Canada actually wants. Mm. In terms of for their government.
Just a quick clarification. Does the UK have proportional representation or not?
It has the exact same system as Canada.
Way,
It's just the fact here is that here you have states very similar to, say, like the US does. In the UK, ours will go by the local authority within the town. So you'll have like the area that you have within that, but that area is a lot smaller. That area might be you know, up to 200,000 people in one place.
Mm-hmm.
You're not having it in terms of where there's provincial laws here, and then there's a federal system within on top of that.
Well, Eva brought up the challenge that Trudeau will face having to even implement this system, and this is the thing, like there's been talk of the referendum. So Sam, what's been, Have you done any like research as to is there a desire for this referendum, like, or is it just too early to tell at this point?
Well,
desire for the referendum from voters to have a referendum about this whole electoral reform thing, because like the conservatives say that that should be the way it's done, and the liberals say, at least in my understanding, that this is the issue they got voted in for, so the referendum's happened.
Yeah. I did. So in the process of sort of researching this topic, I stumbled on a McLean's article, which is like, for those of you who have not read it, I would recommend it. It's fairly short and it gets to the point. But basically it's saying that it's pretty mixed how people actually feel about electoral reform. And that's sort of demonstrated, especially in places where people have already held referendums. Provinces have already held referendums on electoral reform.
Such as right here, BC.
BC, yeah. BC did it, and it failed. Ontario did it, and it failed. PEI did it, and it failed. And a lot of people are not, like, many people are very comfortable with the idea of incremental change to the electoral system. But changing it to proportional representation just like immediately, just completely radically, you know, uprooting the way that people are elected gets a lot of people uncomfortable. You know, 33% in the abacus data from the Broadbent Institute, apparently, only 9% of Canadians thought the voting system needs a total overhaul. So like,
how recent was this?
Let me click through to the link and find out. December 2nd is when...
2015.
From 2015.
Oh, wow. Very recent.
Very recent.
That is very recent.
33% were more or less in favor for major changes. 41% said that only minor changes are needed, and 17% were completely satisfied with the way the system is. So, like, even saying 17% of Canadians are okay with our electoral system as it is, is like, you know, when you're sort of like in a very liberal setting like a university, that big of a margin sounds crazy because it seems like the electoral system has been, you know, so flawed for so long. Why could anybody not want that? Mm-hmm. But, you know, if people are that mixed, I sort of get why not doing a referendum is an idea that they're sort of leaning towards. Even though, you know, if it is a big deal, obviously people should have a say in it.
Yeah. So we're going to shift gears now. Thank you, Sam, for bringing up the electoral reform issue of the Trudeau's campaign. We're going to switch gears, though, to another big news story of 2015. In fact, I guess it's been a big news story for several years now. Alice, what is that story?
So I actually wanted to bring up, and as a topic as a whole, it's really wide, the Syrian refugee crisis, but more specifically to that, and I'm really clear when I say the words refugee and crisis within this, because this will come up in topic later on. I was reading an article in the latest issue of Delayed Gratification magazine, which kind of looks back at big events that have happened in the news 3 months back. So they look back to July, August, September, and they did a really big data visualization piece about the European migrant crisis, is what it's called, in the article. And there was an infographic in there that talked about, showed the change and the shift within language from migrant to refugee once the publishing of the picture of the Syrian boy, Alan Kurdi, was published across newspapers and media outlets and shared, and how that shift within language was really, really clear. There's it's a really interesting infographic in terms of the spikes that happen throughout. So it looks from July over to September, and you'll see that on the 2nd of September, the shift in terms of the number of people who are searching on Google for the term refugee rather than migrant suddenly escalates.
Wow.
And it's not only the case, really, just for on Google. There was a study that showed that there was a similar in terms of a Twitter, in terms of the language used as well. There's been a lot of debate over and criticism to publications and news outlets in terms of the use of the word migrant in the first place and whether it's actually appropriate.
Sorry to cut you off for a second. Was there any determination whether the word migrant versus refugee, was it limited to European publications, or was this a pervasive issue through like global publications, like whether it be North American, Asian, yeah, etc.?
So, I mean, there's been big criticism over two organisations such as the BBC, which is sort of UK publication. There have been studies that have looked at UK publications within that as well. But it also, it translates a lot further than that, especially in terms of when you look at Twitter and Google as a global.
Those are pretty good global indicators.
I'm not talking about it in terms of media outlets, but I'm talking about it in terms of an overall look at how people are using language. Al Jazeera were really clear in their point that they're actually refusing to use the word migrant. They feel that it's dehumanizing and it defaces what they're actually talking about. The two words are very different in their meaning. A migrant is somebody who goes to temporarily or permanently live somewhere that is a country not of their own origin. A refugee is somebody who is forced out of their country. They are fleeing. There is a definite change within the power shift, the reasoning, the connotations that are associated with that. And especially when it comes to something such as journalism, as I'm sure the rest of the panel will know, language is really important and it really frames history, which this is a moment in history that's going to carry on and is going to be looked back on for people in generations to come at how we looked at this. And that language is really, really important to people's mind frame and how people are treated within that situation as well.
Thank you, Alice. And now to finish things up, and which it's great that we're ending with this particular news story because it's come back already in 2016. We got Eva, and she's discussing.
I'm discussing the issue of gun violence and gun control in the U.S.
Ah, yes. It's not a news story that's restricted to 2015, unfortunately.
No, and that's kind of why it came to my mind, just because, you know, it's a new year, and it kind of seems like Obama's making a new resolution this year, too. So just what I was thinking when I was thinking about gun violence is over 2015, it really seemed like there was just kind of this huge increase in the coverage of these mass shootings happening in the United States, San Bernardino, the shooting at the Oregon Community College, the Lafayette Theater. This past week, Obama outlined the executive actions that he plans to take to curb gun violence, and some of those include guidelines for federal agencies and requiring background checks for individuals wishing to purchase firearms. So it really seems like he's kind of put his foot down at this point, and he got quite emotional at the press conference. And just even the media coverage, you know, there was that article by the Washington Post saying that after the Oregon shooting, saying that there had been 294 mass shootings up to that point, and only 274 days had gone by in the year. So it just seems, I'm just wondering, you know, my question is this a turning point for the U.S.? Are they going to start to make changes? Are they going to start to reconsider the Second Amendment, but reconsider how easy it is to purchase a firearm and how easy it is to just walk around with a firearm on you at all times?
It's very interesting because you get these kind of conflicting messages from U.S. media. On one hand, you hear that a lot of people in the U.S. Across the political spectrum support some form of background checks. But then you hear also a lot of people saying that there's not a whole lot that can be done, like with the measures that Obama is introducing. And then like on social media, I've definitely heard it from critics and journalists saying that, like, even the measures that Obama is introducing are more modest and they're not super effective. They may be a step in the right direction for gun control advocates, but for many gun owners, it's seemingly a tedious obstacle, and it's not going to really stop the people who want to commit these shootings. What? Anybody have a thought on that?
Sure.
Sam's going to chime in.
I'll chime in. Right. I got some thoughts.
Some thoughts.
Well, I mean, I think it's really interesting that so many people have been having that line of questioning and really how unfair it is. Because the argument, your solution to the problem is really not going to fix the problem. It might make it a little bit better, but it's not going to fix it, so you shouldn't be trying, is a really, really flawed argument.
And selfish.
And very selfish. But I get where it comes from. You know, the United States has a gun-owning culture. And it is enshrined in the Constitution. It is a thing that is a complete non-starter with a lot of people.
I should also mention that some of the people that make that criticism are people of color and people who are of color that live in communities that are not safe to be in. So I can also see where they're coming from in the sense that it's like, look, like I live in an area where I feel the need for a gun for my own safety and to protect my family, and it's a real need because, like, you can, I mean, if you lived in the South Side of Chicago, maybe, as a legal gun owner, that is that's a different area than if you're just a legal gun owner in, let's say, like, the suburbs of upstate New York. I don't know. I'm just trying to put some.
Hey, man, upstate New York's pretty advocate. Rough. It's pretty rough up there. They've got, like, money and stuff. That's totally legitimate. That is a very, very valid way to look at it. I think that the fact that people are criticizing Obama's, attempts as too modest, though, are kind of missing the point that he's being, like, he's trying to get something done on a topic that, like, Wayne LaPierre, the head of the NRA, went out on live television right after the Sandy Hook shooting and said the words, "The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun." Like, That's the situation that he was wading into when he said, we need to fix this. And the fact that he's getting anything done, I think, is actually a really big deal. I think that
because he's severely limited by Republican Congress.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering, like, do you think that Americans are changing their opinions about this kind of, not, you know, not the NRA ones, and, you know, just kind of the general population of the United States? Like, do you think that they were shocked by the number of mass shootings this year? Because looking back, like, if you ask the average person, they can probably name at least three mm-hmm. by name. You know, when does that happen? Where else does that happen?
Yeah, that is a question that Americans will have to ask themselves. But also, American media needs to start taking charge and maybe critiquing the status quo. And some media outlets do it more than others, but it's very hard to see, like, a very brave, aggressive stance towards gun control from outlets like, you know, like, that are not, that are mainstream outlets, basically, are not quite, seems like they're not taking
that
assertive stance.
There was
that
editorial by the New York Times.
The New York Times, though. I was talking more about broadcast news.
Okay.
But you're right. Bring up the New York Times.
Yeah, so for the first time in how many years? 50 years?
I think it was 90.
For the first time, yeah, in a very long time, the New York Times published an editorial advocating for increased gun control. That was pretty significant.
I guess that shows there is some hope.
There's movement.
There is movement. And you know, the fact that, like, there are some crazy people saying, okay, Obama's, like, taking his power too far, should not necessarily stifle, that should not, like, represent the whole American population, you know, like, the normal average citizen kind of thing. Because that's what I feel. Like, I feel sometimes that we only focus on that, on the gun nuts too much, and are forgetting about the rest of, you know, average American society. All right, well, that was our panel for the year-end 2015 look back on some of the biggest stories of the year. My name is Rohith Joseph. I've been the moderator for this past 20 or so minutes. Thanks again to Eva, Sam, and Alice for their amazing contributions.
Thank you, panelists. That's our program for today, January 8th. Today's newscast was brought to you by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through Facebook, Twitter, or email news@citr.ca.